Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking to one of the leading feminists and social critics of our times about her new book, a striking new book called The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. Our guest today on Media Matters will be Naomi Wolf. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. This week, the issue of net neutrality has come back to the fore. In the House of Representatives, Edward Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, and Chip Pickering, a Republican from Mississippi, introduced the Internet Freedom Preservation Act of 2008. H.R. 5353 would amend the Communications Act to protect the open nature of the Internet and require a series of public hearings nationwide on the future of the Internet. Ben Scott, Policy Director of Free Press, explains.
It signals to the marketplace, to the FCC, and to the rest of the legislators and the public that they represent that an open Internet matters to the federal government and that it will seek to protect consumers' right to speak freely online and engage in commerce in an open marketplace online.
This is an important development for the broad coalition of groups and millions of people who have been fighting to keep the Internet open and accessible without discriminating against content, users, or specific applications.
The bill would, first and foremost, establish net neutrality, the consumer protection of equal access on the Internet, into the foundation of communications law. It is the most forward-looking provision we could ask for out of the Congress directing the FCC to protect an open Internet.
The bill also requires the FCC to study how these open Internet principles should be applied to broadband networks. And, in one of the more novel provisions, the legislation requires the FCC to hold a series of public broadband summits across the country.
This is a critical shift in Internet policymaking. It moves the decision-making outside of Washington, and it opens the door and shines sunlight on what is often a backroom, lobbyists-only deal-making session that typifies telecommunications policy in the District of Columbia.
Open Internet activists are hoping to get 100 sponsors to sign on to the bill in the next 100 days. For more information about the Internet Freedom Preservation Act and contacting your members of Congress, go to savetheinternet.com.
And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact.
The Bush administration released a new report boasting about its success in fostering policies for widespread broadband internet adoption in America. But a survey from the Pew Internet and American Life Project found that roughly half of all Americans don't have broadband at home. And broadband growth in the United States is actually slowing, down 15% from last year's pace.
Despite $11 million spent on lobbying efforts, last year the Tennessee legislature rejected a statewide franchising bill that would have stripped authority to negotiate cable and broadband agreements away from cities and towns. The bill was widely criticized for its lack of build-out requirements, few consumer protections, and no financial support for public, educational, and government channels. Now lawmakers, once again backed by AT&T, are gearing up to reintroduce the bill. But this year, they have a new champion in House Speaker Jimmy Nafee. Nafee, who didn't actively support last year's bill, reportedly has been holding private negotiations between AT&T and the cable industry to work on compromise legislation. What changed? Last year, Nafee's wife, Betty Anderson, known as Tennessee's most powerful lobbyist, worked for the cable industry, which opposed the bill. This year, she signed on as a consultant for AT&T. Nafee says there's no conflict of interest and that the negotiation process has been transparent, and he wants to be sure that, quote, Tennesseans are getting what they're requesting. But public interest groups and community media advocates have not been invited to the meetings, and neither has the press. The industry claims that statewide franchising will result in lower prices, but the evidence is thin. For instance, in Texas, which has had a statewide franchising law since 2005, video prices have not decreased anywhere near the 25 to 30% promised by the phone companies. In fact, nearly every video provider in Texas, including AT&T and Verizon, has raised its prices in the past 2 years. The Tennessee statewide video franchising bill has yet to be put on the legislative calendar. For more information about statewide franchising, go to saveaccess.org or freepress.net/state-tracker. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a wonderful program for you, much anticipated. Our guest joining us is a leading author and social critic, Naomi Wolf, who's probably best known for her landmark international bestseller, The Beauty Myth, a book the New York Times called one of the most important books of the 20th century. She's written for many great publications, written several other books, and now has a new book that has just come out recently with Chelsea Green Publishing, to much acclaim, a bestseller, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, a book that is striking, does not capture the power of this book. It's more of a SOS Mayday alert, I think, than just saying it's a striking chord. Naomi Wolf, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. I'm so happy to be talking to you and to your community.
Well, if you can, I must say, this. When I read this book, it seems somewhat of a departure from your earlier work. Why did you write this book, and why now?
Right. Well, it's true that in the past I've focused mostly on women's issues, but the theme is the same, which is liberty. I mean, you know, feminism is about people constraining women's individual autonomy and choices, and so I was sort of primed to notice issues of liberty being undermined. But I really wrote it as a mother and as an American citizen. I wrote it because I was aware, as I was watching events unfold with the Bush administration, of a sense of deja vu. I guess I also wrote it as a Jew, come to think of it. I had this incredible feeling that some of these images that we're seeing, some of these laws and tactics, were familiar from history. And I would chat about this with a friend of mine who is a daughter of Holocaust survivors. And she kept saying, oh, they did this in Germany, they did this in Germany. And I thought this was very extreme, but then she insisted that I read some history of the Weimar Republic. And what became so clear, just from a few of these books, is that, of course, she wasn't talking about the later years, you know, 1938-39. She was talking about the early years, 30, 31, 32, when Germany was a parliamentary democracy, with, you know, a multiplicity of political parties and newspapers and points of view and a constitution. And she was talking about how a small group of people used the law to subvert the law and put pressure on the Constitution and invoked a threat of terrorism to push parliamentarians to undermine civil liberties and open the door to everything that followed. And I saw that the parallels were so extraordinary, not just in tactics and strategies, but in actual images and sound bites that seem to be being replayed now, that I went and looked at other times and places where a would-be dictator sought to close an open society or crush a democracy movement. I looked at six other such times and places, and I saw that there is a blueprint to close down an open society, and that all would-be dictators take exactly the same 10 steps, and that these 10 steps are definitive. At a certain point, democracy can no longer recover, and that, horrifyingly enough, each of these 10 steps is in fact underway right now in the United States.
Our guest, Naomi Wolf, author of the new book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, joining us today on the phone. We pre-recorded this show slightly before going on air, a few days before airing today. So please don't call in. Sit back, relax, let Naomi Wolf and me do the talking today. I was struck by your use of the Nazi comparison, because generally the sort of casual use of the term Nazi or Hitler to sort of badmouth something you don't like in politics has been used so widely, most people stay away from it, but you really embraced it. And you know, you're aware of that as you write this.
Right, and, you know, let's talk about that. It's very important. I, again, as a Jew who's lost, you know, relatives in the Holocaust, I personally take umbrage when people use a Nazi analogy rhetorically. And readers of The End of America will see that I never use that word or, you know, the examination of how Hitler deployed his subversion of democracy. Rhetorically, there's not a single rhetorical usage in the book. What I'm doing is looking very concretely at the actual historical record and simply looking at the evidence of how, for instance, the National Socialists passed the Enabling Act and Clause 2, which gave the government, in the wake of a hyped terror threat, the power to, for instance, read people's telegrams and open their mail and listen in on their phone conversations, you know, which echoes to detailed degrees the Patriot Act. And, you know, this and dozens of other examples, I simply let the evidence appear before the reader side by side of tactics from the past and tactics in the present, and let the reader decide. So I'm very conservative in what I'm doing. That said, it's even more powerful because by the end of the book, there's simply no way to ignore there's no way to explain it away, you know, other than the having to conclude that someone influential in the White House studied, and there are several people, including Condoleezza Rice and Philip Zelikow and Karl Rove, all of whom are deeply steeped in the history of mid-20th century fascism and totalitarianism, but it's very hard to avoid concluding that these echoes and parallels cannot be random. There are so many of them. I mean, everything from, you know, Heimat, homeland, the use of the word homeland. Well, you know, before 2001, we used to say the Office of Domestic Security or Domestic Policy, so suddenly it was Homeland Security. Well, you know, in 1932, the National Socialists started promoting the use of the word Heimat or homeland, which has a very different chord and echo than domestic or internal. You know, they used to unload the coffins of the war dead at night in Nazi Germany. They unload the coffins of the war dead at night in the Iraq War. They... they referred to torture as enhanced interrogation at Bergen-Belsen. They refer to torture as enhanced interrogation now at the White House. They used waterboarding. The SA used waterboarding in their torture cellars, and we're seeing Mukasey try to defend the illegal use of waterboarding now, and it's not as if, you know, the United States has used waterboarding. You know, in the last 50 years, the last time we used waterboarding was in 1915, and it was illegal at that time. I mean, people were court-martialed for using it. You know, the echoes go on and on. If you look at Leni Riefenstahl's propaganda film, The Triumph of the Will, you see the leader descending in this famous shot from an airplane, you know, landing, people crowding around the door. He opens the door. He's fully uniformed. And he addresses his sort of troops and says, you know, may our mission be accomplished. I don't need to spell out the echo of that. So it's quite striking. And, you know, much more substantively are very important institutional echoes. For example, you know, these 10 steps, you can decide for yourself. The first step every would-be dictator always does is to invoke a terrifying internal and external threat and hype it. For instance, Stalin talked about sleeper cells, another term that the Bush administration has recycled, and that was a completely invented threat. But Pinochet scared Chileans in 73 by talking about real armed insurgents, but then used fake documents to hype the threat, the terror threat, to intimidate Chileans into accepting his coup. And we've seen fake documents with the Panorama forgeries that the White House used to claim that Iraq was acquiring material to build a nuclear bomb. You know, the second thing that would-be dictators always do is to create a prison system outside the rule of law where torture takes place. You know, you decide if there's a practical echo there. And this is very disturbing because they always start by torturing people that citizens see as marginal, and citizens become accustomed to that. You know, and then inevitably there's a blurring of the line where the state starts to go after people at the heart of civil society. So, you know, I don't want to go through all of these prematurely, but it's like the reader can decide, you know, by page 13, whether these echoes are powerful or not.
Yes, Naomi Wolf, we will go through these 10 steps because you have a chapter dedicated to each of them in The End of America, and you've already given us the first two, and we'll go back through those again, too. Before we get into those, though, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about, you know, what would American fascism look like? How do we imagine what, are we in, or maybe the point you're making is we're in the process?
Well, really, truly, it's up to us. I mean, I lie awake nights, depending on what the news of the day has been, wondering if enough people will wake up in time to push back the laws that are now being laid down that will make it impossible for us to push back eventually. For example, right before I started talking to you this morning, someone sent me a story on Alternet, which is predictable from the historical blueprint. I mean, the creepy, terrifying thing about what I found in my book is that the blueprint is predictive, that you can predict 6 months out what the White House is going to do based on the historical blueprint. So according to the blueprint, the months leading up to a national election in a closing society are very unstable. And according to the historical blueprint, something a would-be fascist leader, and I use that term again technically, it means when the state starts to use terror against the individual in an effort to oppose democracy, something they always do is they empower a paramilitary force to act with impunity against citizens. So, and Mussolini pioneered this with the use of the Arditi, the black shirts. Again, Italy was a parliamentary democracy when the black shirts started beating up, newspaper editors and people like you and me, intimidating civilians. Hitler with the brown shirts. Again, it was still a parliamentary democracy, and the brown shirts would, drag people out. Like that kid in Florida, when they asked a tough question in a lecture hall and everyone else would sit there terrified and let it happen when it was still, illegal to do that. So I just read that the FBI has a paramilitary arm, I believe it's Dying Corps, but I need to take another look, but a paramilitary arm like Blackwater, not answerable to the people, not answerable to Congress. They've basically given them impunity to shoot to kill. And I'm reading this with personal trepidation, in the event of martial law. And, personal trepidation because the people who are being targeted in the step 9 and 10 of the historical blueprint, which is start to, identify dissent as treason and criticism as espionage and then start to criminalize thought, which we're starting to see with H.R. 1955, and then, the last step is the subversion of the rule of law and make it easier to declare martial law. So it's, all we need to kind of send a shockwave through society at this point is the deployment of, a handful of paramilitary treated with impunity with orders to shoot to kill in the event of, quote-unquote, a national emergency. And the president, as of the Defense Authorization Act of 2007, now has the power unilaterally to declare a national emergency. So we could see these guys in Midtown Manhattan tomorrow, or in, Urbana, Illinois, tomorrow. And if they shoot civilians, like anti-war protesters or environmental activists, because of some provocation, which, by the way, the U.S. has a long history of staging such provocations with COINTELPRO and so on, then the shock to the rest of us will be so extreme it will be very hard to regroup and respond and push back. And so, this is just one of those sort of points of fragility. That's one way a more dramatic shift into a kind of violently closed society could look in America. At the end of the book, I have several possible scenarios, less violent and dramatic, that are more plausible based on the historical record, but that could equally well serve to essentially continue to close down a formerly open America. And many of them have to do with the subversion of the election, by the way.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, Naomi Wolf, author of the new book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. We're talking about this book on the air. We recorded the show a few days before going on air, so please don't call in. Sit back, relax, and let us talk. Naomi Wolf, in the book, in addition to pointing out the comparison and the similarities and the parallels to totalitarian societies, specifically fascist states, you oppose that to our own founders and sort of revisit their work. And what did you find?
Yeah, again, such an important question. Thank you. Well, when one starts to sound the alarm about a possible despot trying to close down our democracy. It sounds so exotic to many people and so far-fetched, because we have had over 200 years, for most people, of a strong democracy. I mean, obviously, you know, African Americans are much less skeptical than white people, because they know perfectly well that the state can conspire to terrorize and enslave individuals. This is not far-fetched to them. But many Americans just have no concept that democracy is fragile. They assume that democracy is the default, and that, you know, the pendulum will always swing, and we can vote the bums out, and, you know, that democracy will protect us without us needing to lift a finger to protect democracy. But this smugness or complacency would be very horrifying to the founders, because if you go back and look at the documents, the letters they were writing to one another and to the colonists at the time that they were holding the Constitutional Convention and composing the Bill of Rights, they were terrified. They created those documents in a mood of real fear. And their fear was of exactly what we're seeing now, of they knew an American despot could easily arise in America to oppress Americans. They knew it categorically. They understood that it's tyranny that's the default, and democracy is a fragile flower. This is why they put these beautiful checks and balances in place that are being so aggressively undermined right now by the Bush administration. So, for example, why do we have the Fourth Amendment? Oh, gosh, it's, you know, there's this thing about these guys tasked, you know, with a shoot-to-kill order is just so chilling to me. It goes right to the Fourth Amendment. We have the Fourth Amendment, which keeps us safe in our homes and keeps our stuff private. Why? Because the founders lived through the experience of what it was like to be a subjugated population intimidated by a standing army that was not answerable to the colonists. King George's army were Hessians. They were mercenaries like Blackwater, like Dyncorp. And they were armed, and they terrorized the colonists. They burst into their homes. This is why we need, you know, specific warrants rather than blanket warrants, right? They burst into the colonists' homes using general warrants. They smashed up their possessions. They terrified their children. You know, they intimidated the men, and they raped the women. And the colonists, you know, knew how easy it is to subjugate a population, no matter how courageous, if there is a standing army that's not answerable to the people. That's why we have a National Guard that's answerable, mostly in most states, to the governor and the people of that state.
You know, one of the things, just to interject on this point, because I've had the privilege of doing some research on the founders as well and agree with your assessment. Madison in particular was obsessed with the concern with the United States becoming a military empire and how that would undermine the prospect of democracy. That would lead almost inexorably to tyranny.
And tyranny at home or tyranny abroad?
At home. That eventually being an empire abroad and having a standing army leads to corruption and secrecy, and it unravels the prospect of having the rule of law and self-government. And, you know, I noticed you cited Chalmers Johnson, who's been a guest on this program several times. He, of course, argues that the military spending and the sort of empire of the United States is so built into our system that it's untouchable politically, that it's just our political economy depends on it and is based upon it. And in his view, it's a very similar argument to yours, that it's going to lead to the end of democracy and freedoms as we know it. How much do you think this militarism, empire, this sort of by necessity promotes a cult of secrecy and corruption and disrespect for liberties?
I mean, it's a very, very complicated question. Before I try to answer it, I'd like to ask you a question about him.
Hey, it's my show. Watch it.
Right. But does he have a solution? Does he propose a solution? Because I sometimes get quite depressed when I read his work, because I'm not aware that there's a point of intervention for this from his analysis.
I think, my sense is that Johnson basically is like a doctor who just says you have terminal cancer. And your best hope is hospice, I guess. No, I think he's hopeful that people will read books like his and yours and do take the next step, but I don't think he sees that happening right now.
Okay, I hear you. I'm interested to know what the next step would be in his view. I mean, I do not feel that that the connection is as inevitable as he does. I think it's an important connection. I mean, look, since about 1915, we've been engaged in violent regime change, whether it was in Cuba, in Nicaragua, in the Philippines. And by the way, I had a great education, and this was a history that I was just not exposed to, in spite of, you know, many years of being made to read books. But we, you know, most Americans are not aware that even though we've had a strong rule of law at home, our government has been consistently supporting dictators or installing dictators, training at School for the Americas, you know, would-be Latin American dictators in these 10 steps, in the use of terror, death squads against civilians. So in many ways, not everybody sees this on a spiritual level, and I'm not trying to advocate this, but I just can't help thinking about karma, you know, when you see that. Or you can explain it more rationally, it is implausible to think that our government is going to spend, you know, 50 years, 75 years, seeing the benefits of violent regime change, installing violent autocracy in Latin America, in Indonesia, you know, in Saudi Arabia, without someone getting the idea that it can work nicely at home, too. And, you know, I have to throw in some history. This is mind-blowing. And no one taught it to me at Yale or at Oxford. But apparently there was a coup attempt in the United States when a series of major industrialists, including the Singer Sewing Machine, Air, and other major industrialists, including Prescott Bush, by the way, saw the sort of order and wealth creation that was possible in fascist Italy and fascist Germany, and they were looking at the Depression and at FDR's kind of class warfare, you know, legislation from their point of view at home, and they sent agents to study what was working in fascist Germany and fascist Italy, and the agents came back and reported to them, and they, you know, were making plans to round up veterans, half a million American veterans in the bonus March Army to stage a coup against FDR. And a war hero named Smedley Butler.
Yeah.
Oh, you know who this is?
Oh,
well,
sure. He's a legendary figure.
Sorry?
He's a legendary figure.
Well, as I say, you had a much better education than I did, or you're more clued in, because I was astonished. But for those maybe few listeners who don't know, as I didn't, he was recruited to lead this coup, and he infiltrated this group, and he kind of blew the whistle on them to Congress and averted the coup. But you've got, you know, you can't visit the sins of the grandfather on the grandson, but it is worth noting, it's worth recognizing that Prescott Bush, this is well documented, there's a book called IBM and the Holocaust that tracks this kind of corporate partisanship or participation, but Prescott Bush made the Bush family millions in partnership, business partnership, with Fritz Thyssen, who was the head of Krupp's, a major industrialist in Nazi Germany. And this is notable to me because when you look at the drafting of laws like the Military Commissions Act of 2007, they're very carefully written to indemnify the Bush White House against being prosecuted for war crimes. So at the end of World War II, these industrialists, including Thyssen, were prosecuted in the Nuremberg trials. Some of them faced execution and long prison sentences. And for a moment, the commission was going to round up the American partners of these industrialists. So it is plausible, you know, to believe that there is a, you know, a family memory, not only of the profits to be made when corporations, you know, partner with fascism, but also in how to write legislation to indemnify yourself against being prosecuted for war crimes.
Naomi Wolf, our guest, author of the new book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, just published by Chelsea Green. This is a pre-recorded show. We had this interview a few days before going on air, so sit back, relax, and let us talk. In The End of America, Naomi Wolf goes through the 10 steps or indicators a society undergoes as it makes the transition from being a free society to being a fascist society or a totalitarian or authoritarian society. One point that you just touched on right now I think is very interesting is that a lot of research has come out recently on the Nazis and the emergence of the Nazi movement, because there's always been a question about what role did big business, dominant commercial interests play in Germany as Hitler's rising to power. And I think the mainstream view had been that business had been agnostic and sort of then opportunistically signed up at the end when they saw that Hitler had the Nazis were in firm control. New research suggests actually the business was much more comfortable with the fascist movement than previously had been thought. What about in the United States? What you know, we are a corporate-run economy. We are the super capitalist country of the world. That's what drives our country. Are they participating in this process, or are they just sort of snoozing while it goes on, and how will it affect them?
Right. I mean, profits are it's a very important question. And it goes to what I failed to say about your last question about the Chalmers-Johnson analysis. And what I want to say is this. If corporate pressure to militarize overseas and to create police states overseas and at home is not constrained by strong democracy at home, Johnson is right, there's no hope. But what I do want to say is that it's my understanding as corporations become ever more global and powerful, and as I'm about to explain, there is a strong profit motive to close down American freedom and freedom overseas. You look at Northern Europe, where a strong, aggressive, institutionalized set of institutions of civil society are constraining, are putting some limits on what would otherwise be unfettered capitalism. And, you know, you're quite right that more and more research is showing that corporations were not only complicit with fascism in Italy and Germany, but very much supported the development of fascism, because you can, you know, have massive profits if you're using slave labor from Auschwitz, for example, as Krupps did, you know, in concert with Prescott Bush. Or, you know, again, IBM, the Hollerith machine, you know, how did they know how to round up Jews so efficiently when they would move into a city or a town where there were tens or hundreds of thousands of Jews? They could round them up in half an hour. It's because the U.S. industrialist, who was the head of IBM, gave the technology to Nazi Germany in exchange for massive profits, the Hollerith machines. Without the Hollerith machines and this complicity, it would have been very difficult for the war effort to be so successful, or the extermination effort to be so successful. So here's what's driving the profit motive, and it's very chilling. At the end of the Cold War, the third of the U.S. economy that was dependent on Cold War weapons sales was facing declining market share, because peace is bad for business, if you're Boeing or Raytheon. And so what were they looking at? What did they need in order to sustain profit levels and meet the expectations of their shareholders? Well, you need a new enemy. And so it's not coincidental that just as they're losing the Soviet Union as the global enemy, that there would be a move to hype or inflate this kind of ragged band of you know, Muslim fanatics as a global war on terror, this global Islamo-fascist threat. You know, Gordon Brown of England has said Muslim terrorism is a crime, not a cause. He refuses to inflate it as a global threat. And even in the Clinton years, when it was the same bad guys we were fighting, they recognized it as a serious threat, and they were taking steps to, you know, combat it, but they were not saying this is red alert, orange alert, yellow alert. You know, we have to be petrified every minute. We have to use fake documents to hype the threat. We have to, you know, say we can't wait for the smoking gun to come in the form of a mushroom cloud. So there's clearly a profit motive. And what happened was that these corporations shifted their production from Cold War weapon systems to surveillance and security technologies. And so now, for instance, there was a front-page story in the New York Times that Wall Street is investing billions in China because it's so lucrative to run a police state. You need all that technology to spy on everyone. So if it's that lucrative to spy on a billion Chinese, you know, it's equally lucrative if democracy is weakened enough here at home to turn the enemy into us. And certainly you need to hype this global enemy in order to justify the billions of dollars that, you know, that depends on producing and consuming these weapon systems. And by the way, these corporations have lobbyists, and the lobbyists sit down with Homeland Security and help draft the laws. I mean, and now I'm going to finish this thought, which is a terrifying conclusion, but I can't escape it. You know, Hannah Arendt said that evil is banal. So, and I think she's right. I think people can engage in evil completely, you know, unaware or unwilling to look at what they're doing. So look at Guantanamo, and and look at Abu Ghraib. And if you doubt that we're systemically torturing people, you know, you can look at a blog I wrote called What's Probably in the Missing Tapes that draws on documents that the ACLU acquired from the State Department that conclusively shows that we're running a torture factory with commands from the top, from Rumsfeld and Cheney's office. We're suffocating people. We're electrocuting people. We're hanging people by their wrists. We're torturing people. We're killing people systemically in these prisons. So you know, look at Guantanamo and the sexual abuse and the religious humiliation and the torture and the rounding up of innocent people and you know, the whole machinery of it. If you were a Martian looking at this, it's almost as if you could not imagine a more efficient system for guaranteeing that there will be a steady flow of Muslim terrorists. And, a steady flow of Muslim terrorists is good for business.
No, I mean, really, it's out of fiction, out of 1984 almost, the creation of an enemy. You know, one of the points you just made, Naomi Wolf, was about how in Western Europe, these countries have stronger civil societies that sort of are countervailing forces to forces of reaction. They also have much smaller militaries. One other thing they have that the United States doesn't have are much stronger organized labor movements. How much is the decline of labor as any sort of viable economic or political force in the last, 30 or 40 years in the United States contribute to what's going on today?
Well, you know, instinctively it seems like a substantial component, but I'd like to know your thoughts about that. You probably have thought more about it than I have.
Well, actually, I'm not really in this context. I just was, when I was reading your book and hearing you talk now about corporations, generally discussion of the expansion of corporate power is the other side of the coin, is a decline in the power of organized labor.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I would say that it's part of a three-piece puzzle. You know, with the decline of organized labor, I think you see a psychological shift, which is important and bad for us. And what I mean by that is, you know, when there was a strong organized labor movement in this country, whether you were in a union or not, you were familiar with the idea that ordinary working people could band together to basically fight the power effectively. And that mindset was kind of, what is the word when something spreads? Infectious. And now, with organized labor having been sort of chipped away and diminished so much, I think it's one element in what I'm finding as I travel across the country, which is very dangerous, which is that ordinary people no longer feel that they have any power at all to intervene, to make a difference, to stand up for their rights, to confront the powers that be. And this is very dangerous because in a closing society, what the only thing that can stop this kind of movement is millions of ordinary citizens rising up together and confronting this kind of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
But these people count on ordinary citizens feeling what Americans say they're feeling, which is weak, ineffectual, voiceless. I have to say, I've traveled to countries like Sierra Leone, baby democracies, poorest country on the planet, and citizens feel more empowered there than they do in the United States right now. So the kind of abdication of a sense of potential, you know, among citizens, I think is tied to the decline of the labor movement. But probably more critical is the way that special interests buy and sell politicians, because I think that's one reason we're seeing what we're seeing, which is more and more Americans across the political spectrum, because this is such a transpartisan issue, are starting to scream and yell at Congress about the Constitution, the rule of law, and say things like, you know, hold hearings, hold investigations into whether the administration, you know, committed crimes, hold people accountable. And Congress is just ignoring them, you know. And this seems bizarre, like we can't figure out what is wrong, what's wrong with Nancy Pelosi, what's wrong with Harry Reid. But I talked to a colleague of mine on the Hill who works with a congressman, and he basically said, you know, confirmed what people intuit, which is that basically they don't want to hear from their constituents. Their constituents are an annoyance to them because what really matters is the donors and the special interests. That piece helped to break us apart.
Okay, I think you're now rivaling Chalmers Johnson in the depressing outlook.
I know, but unlike him, I have I have a strong set of recommendations about how to counter this.
That's true. In the book also, we have not gone through in detail all of the 10 steps, which I almost, to some extent, don't want to go too much detail because they're the heart and soul of the book, and I think the comparisons are chilling. One point I would like to talk about that is important in discussions of Nazism, which, of course, is racism. And most conceptions of American fascism are predicated on that the playing on the white supremacy, which is America's great tragic history, will be a central theme to sort of mobilize mass support and fear, or the sort of defensive, well, in the 19th century it would have been, you know, Northwestern Europeans. Now it's sort of broader white people in general. Is how significant is racism in your view in the ending of America? And if it is significant, what does the changing demographics of this nation spell for this sort of movement?
Yeah, you know, actually it's completely immaterial in my analysis. Completely immaterial. And I respectfully think that people like Chris Hedges and other commentators on the left who identify American fascism with sort of an evangelical movement or an anti-immigrant impulse or an anti-gay impulse are profoundly mistaken and actually quite dangerously looking in the wrong direction. There are two things that I really need people to understand about a fascist shift. You know, the National Socialists used virulent anti-Semitism as a pretext and as a mobilizer, but it wasn't the heart of their program. Terror against civilians was at the heart of their program. And people really, and I think partly, I'm going to say this very gently, I'm Jewish, okay, I just want to stress, I'm Jewish. Part of the misunderstanding of the Nazi project and part of the misunderstanding of the collusion of ordinary citizens in Germany comes from, you know, a generation of, understandably, Jewish historians focusing on anti-Semitism as the key element of National Socialism. And really, it wasn't. You know, they were rounding up anarchists and communists and labor leaders and opposition leaders before they were systematically targeting Jews. And what is really important to understand about the way German society closed down is that most people didn't support National Socialists. Most people weren't even anti-Semites. Most people weren't bloody anti-Semites. But that in one spring, between January and April of 1933, it became mortally dangerous as an ordinary German citizen to speak up against Nazis. You could die. And so at that point, people began to align themselves with National Socialism just to save themselves and to save their families, certainly save their jobs, but really to save their lives. And at that point, they, you know, went along with anti-Semitism, probably, you know, many of them internalized it over time. But really, the reason I'm so petrified about these paramilitaries who are armed is that there is no question, if you look at Nazi Germany, that all it takes to close down a democracy is for people, ordinary people, to be scared they'll be killed. And that it doesn't take a huge movement of paramilitary killing people to send that chill throughout society. So, respectfully, I think that, you know, certainly a would-be American fascism might use anti-immigrant sentiment to give juice to what they're doing, or might use, you know, anti-gay sentiment. But it's not necessary. It's just not necessary. I mean, look at what's going on right now. The move into Iraq, the move to kind of subvert the Constitution, it's all happening without playing on any kind of racism at home. Now, what they are playing on is violent, violent racism in relationship to whipping up fears around Muslims. I was on Fox News recently, and I was horrified to be watching the segment right before mine, where they had some random quote-unquote expert from the Bush White House showing this, I believe, fully staged clip of alleged child Al-Qaeda terrorists. Very scary clip, totally fake, right? I have sources in the intelligence agencies, high-up sources, who say that there is such a thing called psyops and info-ops, meaning fake, you know, propaganda, you know, created. And I think the Gulf of Hormuz scare was, you know, one such fake thing that, you know, Associated Press, you know, blew their cover on it. But it's not unheard of. It's very common for a regime to create, you know, propaganda documents to whip up war hysteria. It happened with the sinking of the Maine. It happened with the Hearst, you know, yellow journalism. And so, you know, in the wake of this clip, there was this guy from the White House saying to this Fox News anchor, Of course, Muslims want to kill their own children in order to turn them into martyrs. He didn't say extremist Muslims. He didn't say fanatical Al-Qaeda sociopaths. He just said Muslims. And it's exactly like, you know, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. You know, Jews want to kill little Christian boys and girls to drain their blood and put it in, you know, matzah for their... I mean, they used to say this, and people believed it. So, yes, there is racism in that regard in the step one, which is the invoking of the terrifying internal and external threat.
Naomi Wolf, our guest, author of The End of America. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. This is a show we recorded a few days before going on air, so just sit back, relax, let us handle the remainder of the program. In the book, you go through 10 steps that the United States is currently going through that other nations that shifted to fascism have gone through, and we've discussed a lot of them. One of them I do want to talk about that we haven't mentioned yet are restrictions on the press and the role of the press, because as the founders made it clear, our fourth estate, the press, was the institution that was going to be the sentinel to safeguard our liberties so the people would have the information they'd need to prevent tyranny from taking place. And your sense of how that's going?
Yeah. And you know, before I speak to that, I just want to note that it actually was a fight even in the founders' day. People like Jefferson, you know, firmly believed that the press should be free to criticize everything, which is a very radical idea at that time. You know, Tom Paine, who wrote The Rights of Man, was tried in Britain for sedition, for holding, you know, a sort of Republican and anti-monarchist point of view, and he could have been rendered, you know, and killed as a result of his sentence in Britain. But however, you know, President Adams, of course, passed the Alien and Sedition Acts because he wanted to shut up criticism from the press, and it took a push back to repeal those laws. So there's always been a struggle, you know, between in America between the First Amendment and people in power who don't like to be criticized. Thankfully, the First Amendment has always won out. But you're quite right that the founders understood that Americans had to be free to speak up in order to safeguard liberty. We're in terrible shape in regard to that.
Well, not just speak up, Naomi Wolf. I think they also understood it was they had to know what was going on in order to govern their lives. That just being able to speak up wasn't of much value if you didn't know what you're talking about.
You're completely right, and this goes to a really important distinction citizens have to understand about the nature of lies in a closing society. I've got this section on lies in the book. You know, like, why 930 lies going into Iraq? Why does the Bush White House flood the landscape with lies, some of them which just seem completely unnecessary? And, you know, if you look at totalitarian or fascist regimes of the past, you understand the purpose that lies serve in a closing society. It's different from why people lie in a democracy. In a democracy, people lie to spin or to protect their position, but there is a ground of truth, you know, that is the goal. In a closing society like in China, lies are used to disorient people so that citizens eventually, and this is what's happening now in the United States, it's hard for people to know what's going on. And this is what a would-be dictator really wants. A would-be dictator wants to flood the plane of discourse with lies so that eventually citizens stop feeling confident that they can distinguish between truth and falsehood. So you're right about that. Now going to the point of how's the press doing? Oh, man. You know, in Iraq, the U.S. military is actually seizing journalists like a staffer of CBS, a staffer of the Associated Press, and holding them in these violent prisons without charges being filed and, you know, possibly torturing them or abusing them. CBS and AP can't get their people out, which I think is bound to have a chilling effect. You know, if you're covering the White House and they've got your guy in prison and God knows what they're doing to him. That's what happens in Argentina, you know, during the dirty war. So that's what's happening overseas. And I've got these very scary examples of journalists being fired at, you know, attacked, assaulted, kidnapped by the U.S. for their views. But at home, it's not so much better. People are going to jail, like Josh Wolf, who's no relation, a blogger in San Francisco, is in a federal prison right now. Other people are being targeted. The White House threatened to use the Espionage Act against reporters for the New York Times who disclosed the classified information that let us know that we're being spied on, our phones are being listened to, our emails are being read. Now, the Espionage Act was last used in the run-up to World War I as a way of rounding up people like us, journalists, critics, opposition leaders, child labor activists, rounding people up without warrants and putting them in jail cells where many of them were beaten. And the Espionage Act was used to criminalize dissent. Eugene Debs got a 10-year prison sentence under the Espionage Act for giving a speech about the First Amendment. And this was so effective that it closed down dissent in this country for a decade. So this is not happy, you know, when the White House starts to invoke the Espionage Act against journalists. You know, half the journalists I know could be, you know, facing 10-year prison sentences for trading in classified information because this administration continually classifies and declassifies information, and that's what journalists are supposed to do, right, is you know, break open the secrets.
Now, Nancy, you know, we've only got a few minutes left, and I could do one of those Jerry Lewis marathons with you because there's so much material we haven't even touched on yet. So if I can just take the last few minutes to touch on a few points I do want to get to before the show ends. First of all, we have an election coming up, and do you think the outcome of the presidential election and the congressional elections can fundamentally change things, or are these forces in play more deep and more profound?
Well, okay, two things. First, if by some miracle there's a transparent, accountable election in November, and by an extra miracle, you know, the other side gets in, we're facing just as serious a situation because the founders knew that it doesn't matter who holds power. It's human nature to abuse these powers if they're unconstrained. So it would be just as dangerous to live in an America where an Obama or President Hillary could lock up Matt Drudge for 3 years in a prison cell as an enemy combatant the way you and I can be locked up right now by the Bush administration, no matter how innocent we are, no matter that we're U.S. citizens. So it's dangerous, and what's really dangerous is that people don't give up power once they have it. So it's going to take this push from us. But the second thing is, you know, I think we're looking the wrong place. We cannot be sure that we're going to have a safe election. We can't be sure that we will be safe up until November unless we push back and restore the rule of law. Because between now and November, you know, any kind of instability can take place and is likely to. You know, drumbeats of war against Iran, you know, faked staging of provocations, you know, by Iran, God forbid, you know, a provocation, you know, agents of the state dressed like, and this is a very normative thing to do, dressed like anti-war activists or voter registrants, engaging in some kind of violence to, you know, give an excuse for there to be an emergency declaration or, you know, even just, right, the U.S. attorney scandal. You know, since I was reading about Goebbels, when I read about the U.S. attorney's scandal, I knew that it was likely they were thinking of purging all the U.S. attorneys. This is what Goebbels did in 1933. And, you know, dictators love holding elections. They hold elections all the time. They just make sure that their guys are the U.S. attorneys or the equivalent. Their guys are the judges. Their guys are the ones deciding the outcome in a close election. So we have a lot of work to do before we can rest on our laurels.
And you, at the end of the book, do outline an organization, the American Freedom Campaign, that you're involved with that is trying to coordinate work on this front?
Exactly. Please go to the back of the book or to the Internet, theamericanfreedomcampaign.org. We have started a democracy movement based on democracy movements like the ones that brought down the wall, brought down the Soviet Union. We need a democracy movement in America, and it's a grassroots movement. It also has a legislative component in legislation like close down Guantanamo, forbid warrantless wiretapping, restore habeas corpus, and also a media war room to support the message that our liberties enhance our national security. We need everybody's help.
You made the point, Naomi Wolf, earlier in the program that this is not just a left-right issue in the American sense of liberal and conservative. In fact, there are Republicans and self-identified conservatives who are very much in your court, would you say?
Yeah, and I'm in their court. I mean, this is so, as I said, so transpartisan an issue. And what's been very moving to me is traveling across the country and being so sort of warmly supported by people across the political spectrum who love this country and who, Republicans, evangelicals, Democrats, progressives, Green Party, doesn't matter, they believe in freedom, and it's up to all of us to stand up together to save the country.
Yes, so I read your book. There was one thing that really was striking to me. When we hear the drumbeats of war against whatever the country is, Iraq, now Iran, North Korea, you pick the country, invariably one of the great claims is that this country is unstable, it's run by a lunatic, it could be Pakistan even, and it has access eventually to a nuclear weapon that could do great damage to us in the hands of unstable people. And, you know, you, as I read your book, you couldn't help but escape by the end of the book saying, well, if you're anywhere else in the world, and you're looking at the country that is by far the dominant military power, that has more enough nuclear weapons probably to blow up the whole solar system,
yeah.
And it's run this way, I mean, what, that is the most depressing and chilling observation I came away with.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable at the end of the book to consider that, as scary as it is for us, at home, to be facing an America unconstrained by democracy. Imagine the rest of the world. I mean, if they can render people now off the streets of, you know, Macedonia, you know, and spirit them away and they're never heard from again, you know, an America unconstrained by democracy at home could render, you know, EU ministers off the streets of Brussels, and no country in the world will be able to stand up to the United States. It's a very chilling thought, and it's up to us to make sure it never happens.
Now, one last point on media before we wrap up. What about the Internet? Doesn't this offer a communication vehicle that the forces of reaction and tyranny cannot control?
Ideally, yes. I'm sorry to sound so kind of overwhelmed. It's like ideally, yes, if. Ideally, yes, if we restore the rule of law in Congress. Because, you know, the third thing that the Myanmar junta did when they cracked down on a democracy movement in Myanmar was to suspend text messages. And Verizon, I believe, it ran a trial balloon of suspending messages from, you know, an entity whose politics didn't align with White House politics. It would take, you know, right now there's legislation to indemnify the telecommunications giants against their illegal reading of our email, allowing the government to read our email, spy on us, listen to our phone calls. And I'm hearing reports of people whose email is being tampered with and censored, you know, because they're engaged in criticism of the Bush White House. It is so easy for corporations to close these lines of communication down, and it is standard practice in Russia, in Pakistan. It is standard practice to crack down on the Internet, on phone conversations, on other ways for citizens to communicate. So it's up to us to push back and not become complacent at all.
Naomi Wolf, we are just about to wrap up. What are you working on now? Where do you go for the next 6 months or year?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm truly working night and day to try to, you know, push the American Freedom Campaign to be a bulwark against these abuses and really to prosecute these criminals, because history shows that it's not enough to impeach them or wait for them to get out of office. It's not safe till they're behind bars if they've committed crimes.
You know, Naomi, I hear the band tuning up in the background now. That means they want to kick me out of the studio.
Okay.
I want to thank Naomi Wolf for being our guest today, author of the new book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you.
Oh, likewise. Thank you so much.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for engineering the show, Andrew Boyle for being the producer, and I'll be back in 167 hours.